Welcome to The Director's Chair, a Lowy Institute podcast. My name is Michael Fawley-Love and I'm the Executive Director of the Lowy Institute. On The Director's Chair, I sit down with political leaders, policymakers, and commentators in order to understand what's happening in the world. My guest today is one of Australia's most experienced, savvy, and fearless public servants, Dennis Richardson, who's joining us from his home in Canberra. Dennis retired as the Secretary of the Department of Defence in 2017, ending a storied public service career that lasted almost half a century, in which he served with a dozen prime ministers. And some of the big jobs he held in that period included Secretary of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, Secretary of Defence, Ambassador to the United States, and Director General of Security. Thank you, Dennis Richardson, for agreeing to speak with me today on The Director's Chair.
Pleasure, Michael. Good to be here.
All right, let me start at the beginning. I think I'm right that you were born in Kempsey, but you grew up in Albury. Is that right, Dennis?
That's right. I lived in Kempsey for about 7 years, and then family moved to Albury.
What did your parents do for a crust?
They worked on the railway. My father was a shunter, and he got transferred from Kempsey to Albury. My mother worked on the railway and also worked in motels. In fact, my mother's still alive and living in Casino.
All right, so you went to university, you finished up, I think you wanted to be a teacher, and I think it was Professor Neville Meaney at University of Sydney who pointed you in the direction of the Department of External Affairs as it then was.
Yep.
What was the department like when you first joined it? What did it feel like as the son of someone who worked on the railways? Is the stereotype true that it was full of smooth private school types? What was it like fronting up to the department?
Oh, no, it was more mixed. One, it was a lot smaller.
Yep.
Which meant that at one level, people knew you up and down the ladder. However, it was also more formal. You addressed a lot of people as Mr. and Mrs. Well, very few misses, because women only a couple of years before had been allowed to stay in the public service after being married. Up until then, they had to resign. The department was headed up by a great Australian diplomat, Sir James Plimsoll.
Mm-hmm.
He knew everyone in the department. As a trainee, walking down the steps inside External Affairs about 4 months after I started work, a voice from behind, Sir James Plimsoll, said, Mr. Richardson, how are your parents getting on with the floods in Albury? He could engage with anyone across the department like that. It was small enough to do that. So it was both more informal and more formal than what it is today.
You had a very successful early career in foreign affairs. You had some interesting postings. And then in the early 1990s, you were appointed as Chief of Staff to Prime Minister Bob Hawke, who passed away last year. What were your impressions of Hawke, and how do you think he compared with other prime ministers you've known?
Well, he was clearly a great prime minister. There is no question of that. I think any of the critics would put him up there as one of the greats. He had a marvellous capacity to focus on the issue in front of him. He had this capacity to move from issue to issue and give it his total attention, regardless of what had come before.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, on the night that he was challenged by Keating, Keating came around to the office around about 10 past five in the afternoon. And once Keating had advised Hawke of what he was doing and what was going to be on the Channel 9 news that night with Laurie Oakes, Hawke got his closest cabinet colleagues around and spent from around 6 at night till around 1:30 in the morning talking about tactics, ringing members of the caucus and all of that. At the end of it, he called me in and he said, look, have you got those papers for the Premier's conference tomorrow morning? And I said, Prime Minister, you're on top of all of that. Probably better if you go home and get a good night's rest. He said, no. He said, I want to be on top for the meeting. He prided himself on always being prepared for meetings. I took the papers into him and he stayed there for an hour and a half until 3 a.m. preparing for the Premier's conference. Think about it. He had been challenged that night by his treasurer. He knew what was coming, but he still had the capacity to put that to one side and go through his papers for an important meeting the next morning at 9 a.m. Not too many people could do that.
Mm.
So tremendous powers of focus and concentration.
Compartmentalization, yeah.
Absolutely.
You're a long-term observer of politics. You're a political junkie. When you look back on the last decade, how do you explain our recent run of PMs? Because from 1983 to 2007, we had only two governments, very successful governments, three prime ministers. And in the period since then, we've had five or six prime ministers, depending on how you count them. Now, is that down to those individuals or is it down to the system? And is that period behind us now, do you think?
I think it's largely behind us. I think it's due to very often instability can follow a long period of stability. The coalition went through a period of instability following Sir Robert Menzies and Harold Holt's demise, went through a period of some uncertainty. Prime Minister Howard was a tremendous leader. You couldn't have worked for anyone better than Howard in a crisis. However, each of the prime ministers that followed Howard had significant achievements on the foreign policy front. Kevin Rudd played a very important role in the formation of the G20 leaders meeting. He worked very hard at that, harder than what a lot of people understand.
Mm-hmm.
Julia Gillard had a Howard-like approach to foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
The way she managed China and Japan was superb. You might recall she took on the left, even though she came from the left, she took on the left of the Labor Party to overturn their long-standing opposition to selling uranium to India. And without that, we wouldn't have the relationship with India that we have today. Tony Abbott had a real focus when he came in on border security.
Mm-hmm.
You can either agree with his policies or not, but I think John Howard was probably the only other prime minister of that era who might have had the wherewithal to do what Abbott did. It took a lot of strength to do that. And Malcolm Turnbull had the challenge of President Trump, and he handled that superbly well.
Fair enough, and you're being generous to each of those prime ministers, but the devil's advocate would say, okay, that's fine, but none of them were able to bring their party along, retain the confidence of their party room, and win successive elections in the way that the prime ministers that came before them did so. What was their Achilles heel? Why were they not able to do what their predecessors could?
Oh, I think it was a mix of the times, a mix of personalities, and a mix of party intrigue. All those things came together. But don't forget, we live in an age where the idea is to pull everyone down.
Mm-hmm.
You pull your institutions down, you pull people down.
Mm-hmm.
There's not too many professions that have got away over the last 40 years without losing a heck of a lot of skin.
Mm.
And it's fashionable in Australia to get stuck into our prime ministers. In point of fact, we have bloody good leadership in this country.
Let me ask you one more question about PMs, Dennis. Who was the most enjoyable prime minister to be with? Which of the PMs that you worked with had the best sense of humour?
Bob Hawke was very sensitive about his height. In fact, you can look at certain photographs and you can see him standing on his toes. I remember one time on a 707, I was up the front having lunch and a briefing with Prime Minister Hawke, Hazel Hawke, and John Bowen, who's his foreign policy advisor. Hazel said something like, "Well, Bob, you and Dennis are about the same height." Anyway, Hawkey went off his tree on this. "Hazel, that's just outrageous. I'm clearly taller than Dennis." And he made us both stand up in the cabin to have our heights measured. And yes, sure enough, he was a bit taller than me and the point was won. But he had the capacity. He saw the funny side of that. The rest of us laughed and that. So he had a very good sense of humour. And all the other prime ministers enjoyed a good laugh, enjoyed a good joke. They're all decent people, Michael. They're not bad people.
All right, let me go on from politics to ASIO. You served as Director of Security from 1996 to 2005, and that was a period that covered the 9/11 terrorist attacks and also the Bali bombings. Those events struck home right at the heart of the Western Alliance and indeed the heart of Australia. When we look back on that period, some critics would say that all of us overestimated the terrorist threat. It was a very serious thing. It was a very big deal. But with the hindsight of history, it led us into Afghanistan, then Iraq, the forever wars, and perhaps it created space for other adversaries to rise and perhaps contributed even to the election of Donald Trump and the sort of move towards retrenchment in the United States that we see now under President Trump. Is that fair, do you think? Do you think that we over-egged the pudding?
Look, that is a reasonable perspective. However, I think it underestimates the power of an event like 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
You have the US going about its daily life, and all of a sudden, 3,500 people are murdered in the middle of New York, out of the blue. That has an impact on a country, I think. It's easy to sit back 20 years later and say, we overreacted.
Mm-hmm.
People often talk about terrorism and they say, more people get killed in road accidents, more people get killed here and there, it's all exaggerated, etc. Well, when you cross the road, you feel as though you've got some control. When you get into a car, you feel as though you've got some control. You're aware of the risks, but you're also conscious that you have some control. People don't like the notion that they can be going about their normal lives, sitting in a cafe in Martin Place or being somewhere else in a restaurant or having a holiday in Bali and getting blown up simply because someone is attached to a particular extreme ideology.
Mm-hmm.
There is something that strikes at the heart of people's psyche when that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if a 9/11 happened again today, you would see a pretty strong reaction from any country which was the victim.
In 2005, Dennis, you were appointed ambassador to the United States. And I remember you said at the time, in this job, I'm paid to be nice to people. In my last job, I wasn't. Did you enjoy being nice to people? Was that the most fun job of your career, being ambassador in Washington?
It's hard work being nice to people all the time. It genuinely is. And it is emotionally wearing if you have a job where most of the time you've got to have a smile and be nice. Fortunately, being ambassador in the United States, there was plenty of opportunity to also have other emotions. The thing about the job in Washington was it didn't matter how busy it was. It didn't matter how demanding it was. It was always enjoyable. I once said to Prime Minister Howard, I said, the dirty secret of this job is that I do it for nothing. Of course, I wouldn't, because I wouldn't be able to afford to. But it was a great job. I mean, you would find yourself in situations and in circumstances where you'd pinch yourself and you'd say, is this real?
Now, I know that like me, Dennis, you enjoy the United States. And I remember you and your wife, Betty, visited all 50 states, I think, when you were ambassador.
Yeah, we did.
What have you made? How have you felt of the last few years as you watch the United States with the election of Donald Trump, the mediocre US response to COVID, the great suffering we're seeing, 110,000 dead now in the United States, and now these protests following the killing of George Floyd, the militarized response that the president has advocated, even that vision of Lafayette Square being cleared by tear gas so that the president could pose in front of St. John's Episcopal Church with a Bible. How does it make you feel as someone who really enjoys America and is very fond of that country?
You don't look at all of that with any sense of joy. In fact, I think you've got to have an historical perspective to understand the US. You go back to Washington and Jefferson and Adams and Hamilton. Right at the very beginning, they didn't get on all that much. You fast forward to the expansion westwards and what that entailed in terms of Native Americans. You go back to the days of slavery. You go back to the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
You go back to the cronyism of the late 19th century. You have to have all of that in mind when you look at the US today, because if you don't have that historical perspective, you would become thoroughly pessimistic and you would see no future for the US. I think the partisanship in the US is something that's been developing now for some years. It hasn't all of a sudden fallen on the US with Trump. It has certainly got worse. And the partisanship is something that I find most disconcerting, where opposition in the United States is now about stopping your opponents from governing.
There's something particular about Trump, isn't there, Dennis?
Oh, yeah.
We have a leader of the free world who doesn't appear to believe in the free world. And many of the things that Australians believe in, like trade and alliances and internationalism and all those sorts of things, he disbelieves in them.
I think he sees the world entirely through his own image of himself. I think he personalises everything. I think he sees his political fortunes tied up entirely in terms of his base. So he plays to a narrow constituency. He doesn't seek to broaden his constituency. And his language is extraordinarily aggressive. He is a very different leader. Some of what he's about, you can understand. He's not the first president to want allies to do more in terms of their own defence. However, he has pursued it in an aggressive manner that I think has put some allies off.
All right, Dennis, you returned to Canberra from Washington in 2010, and you served for a couple of years as Secretary of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, which is the department in which you started your career. Let me ask you, who would you rate as Australia's best foreign minister?
You could argue forever in terms of the emergence from the Second World War. You could argue that Spender was only there 18 months, but he had a tremendous historic influence in terms of ANZUS. You could argue Gough Whitlam for the short time he was foreign minister. He took us out of Vietnam. He signed up to umpteen conventions and the like. You could argue Gareth Evans. Look at Cambodia. I personally think there was a very strong argument for Gareth Evans to get the Nobel Peace Prize for what he did in Cambodia. I think people have got their Nobel Peace Prize for less than what Gareth Evans did. You could argue Alexander Downer in terms of the East Asia Summit and his engagement with Howard following the 2004 tsunami. So there's a variety of people who you can put the case for. I'm not going to put the marker on one or the other. I'm simply a coward on these things, Michael.
I thought you'd be frank and fearless, Dennis.
You're frank and fearless with the people who you should be. When you're in a public space, you need to be careful.
All right, fair enough. Let me ask you a different question. After working in the machine for so long, do you think Australians are good at foreign policy? Are we good at foreign policy and diplomacy? What are our strengths in that game and what are our weaknesses?
What's been the essence of our foreign policy over the last 70 years, Michael? It has been one, engagement through international organisations. Two, a strategic alliance with a great power in the United States. And thirdly, engagement independently in the region. Now, how have we done on that? We were at the forefront of putting the UN together. We're at the forefront of putting the South Pacific Forum together. We're at the forefront of the creation of APEC, both APEC itself in Bob Hawke's speech in Seoul in January, February of 1989, and Paul Keating's push for an APEC leaders meeting. We're at the forefront of the East Asia Summit, making sure we were there at the beginning, and we played a leading role in putting together the G20 leaders meeting. We don't have a bad record when it comes to that. Throw in the position we took in the formation of Bangladesh, throw in the position we took when Suharto replaced Sukarno in 1965 and Indonesia was falling apart, and the role we took in economic support for Indonesia, throw in the role we took in East Timor in the late 1990s, throw in our response to the tsunami in 2004, throw in the Pacific step up, we do get some things right.
Your last big job, I guess, before sitting on the board of the Raiders, of course, was Secretary of the Department of Defence from 2012 to 2017. And let me ask you, when you were Secretary, Australia decided to go with Naval Group from France to build our new attack class submarines. This is the largest contract in the history of the Commonwealth of Australia. How's it going?
One, I'm no longer part of it, but listening to Cent Estimates and listening to the public debate, I think it's not going too bad. In fact, my marker is Greg Sheridan. Greg Sheridan felt it was the worst decision we'd ever made. He now says it's not a bad one. And Greg's a pretty good judge of these things. Look, it was a decision taken on merit. It was competition between the Germans, the Japanese, and the French. The Japanese were not prepared to share with us their best technology. The Germans had a very good industrial plan, but the capability of what they were putting forward wasn't there. The French were prepared to share with us some pretty sensitive technology, which at the end of the day, some people were surprised at their preparedness to share. There's a cultural divide there between us and the French. We do things rather differently, but there was going to be a cultural divide whether we went with the Japanese or the Germans. So it's there. It's going to be hard work. But we're on track to have a new submarine in the water in the early 30s. Important thing for us is the future submarine should be the last conventional powered submarine Australia has. We should have, following that, a nuclear powered submarine. You might think that's off in the distance, but it's not. If we're going to have a nuclear powered submarine, we're probably going to have to change the legislation in respect of nuclear energy in this country. Doesn't mean to say we have to have nuclear power, but we'll need to have some capability and the like. It's going to require a national enterprise. If we're going to have a nuclear powered submarine following the future submarine, it means we're going to have to start to build a nuclear powered submarine somewhere between 2050 and 2060. If we're going to do that successfully, we'll need to make a decision over the next 10 years. We will need to make a decision to go down that path by 2030. So people talk about it as though it's off in the distance. It is a decision that is coming up, and we need to face up to it.
All right, let me ask you this. The country whose emergence has changed our strategic circumstances more than any other is China. And one big job you never had was ambassador to China, although I saw someone suggest a few weeks ago that all the problems in the bilateral relationship could go away only if Dennis were to be our special envoy to Beijing.
They clearly don't know me.
Let me ask you this. What's gone wrong in the bilateral relationship? Did you support the Morrison government's call for an independent international investigation into the origins of the coronavirus pandemic? And is there something about the public debate on the Australia-China relationship that's going off the rails, do you reckon?
Let's take that one by one, Michael. First of all, China has changed since 2012. You can make critical comments about some of Australia's approaches and the way we've gone about things. However, it is China that said they would not militarize the South China Sea, but went ahead and militarized it. It is China that appears to be walking away from its agreement, international agreement, in respect of Hong Kong. It is China that has sought to improperly engage in Australia's internal domestic affairs. We have responded to those things, and we have responded fairly forcefully. I think we were right to call for an independent inquiry re the coronavirus. I think we could have gone about it somewhat differently than what we did. The bottom line is very clear. If we want a proper review of all matters relating to coronavirus, we need China's cooperation. You don't get that by prejudging. You don't get that by slapping them in the face to start with. You've got to do that in a particular way. What's gone wrong in Australia. I think we sometimes belt ourselves up too much in terms of what's gone wrong in respect of China. I think China has changed more than us. However, China is here. China's not going to go away. It's going to become more powerful. It's probably, over time, will become the dominant military power in the Western Pacific, probably single power. And we need to engage with it sensibly and with maturity. You know, we all know what authoritarian regimes are like. We don't need to be told ad infinitum every day by particular groups that, look, China's authoritarian, they're terrible. We know what authoritarian regimes are like. We've still got to deal with them and we've still got to engage with them. And we need to put a little bit more intellectual muscle in terms of that. We are not in a bad position because we have a lot of flexibility when it comes to the region. If you look at the arc from North Korea around to Pakistan, China does not have a lot of close friends. We do. And we do have options there. We do have a capacity to work our diplomacy in respect of ASEAN, Indonesia in particular, Japan, Korea, India and the like. We should do all of that and at the same time think through and work harder on developing a more positive relationship with China. There's no point in just standing on the sidelines throwing stones at China. We need to engage whether we like them or not. And I think sometimes certain sections of the commentariat forget that.
All right, final question, Dennis. I'm asking all my guests on the director's chair what they're liking about lockdown or what they're learning about lockdown. I'm sure you're missing lots of things during this period, including attending Raiders games at GIO Stadium. But is there something you've liked about this period?
I've not found the lockdown too bad, quite frankly. Betty and I have been sensible. We've followed all the advice, but we've not allowed it to imprison us. We've actually got out every day. Mm-hmm. We've even, you know, I shouldn't say it, we've even gone for a drive around the suburbs of Canberra. It's amazing what you can find interesting when you're in lockdown.
And let me ask you this. Australia has been one of the most successful countries in dealing with COVID, and you've seen the federal government gets some big decisions right, the opposition do the right thing, state governments, chief medical officers all sort of pull together. You've spoken once or twice on this podcast about not always belting ourselves up. Should that be a subject of some quiet pride that the Australian system has somehow got it right?
Absolutely. And it shouldn't surprise us that we got it right. We get a lot of things right in this country. We get a lot of things wrong, but understandably, and this is think tanks and the media rightly focus on what we can do better. Mm-hmm. And they rightly focus on what's gone wrong. That's a good thing, Michael. That's not a bad thing. And I think it's because we have that robust debate in this country. That's at the heart of why we do well. Really, if we were to spend most of our time like I have on this podcast, patting ourselves on the back, then we would become very complacent and we would perform very poorly. It's precisely because we have people like yourself, quite frankly, and commentators in the print media and on TV, pointing fingers, asking questions, belting leaders over the head. The fellow the other day who told the Prime Minister to get off the grass. I mean, no, it is precisely because of that guy being able to do what he did, that we get so many things right. And it's precisely because he did what he did that you can only have a discussion like this where a person talks about the positives from time to time. If we were to do this every day, it would be hopeless. However, once in a year, you can afford to have someone on your podcast who is more positive.
Well, I've really enjoyed it. Thank you, Dennis, for joining me on the director's chair to reflect on your career as one of Australia's most influential public servants. Let me say, I'm not a Canberra Raiders supporter. I'm more of a Souths supporter, but I did think the Raiders were treated very unfairly last year. So maybe we can agree that the Raiders should always beat the Roosters.
I think we can agree on that. And this year, put your money on the Raiders.
Thanks, Dennis.
Okay. Beauty, Michael. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to The Director's Chair, a podcast by the Lowy Institute, hosted by me, Michael Fullilove, with production assistance from Madeline Neist. Thanks for listening, and please tune in to the next episode of The Director's Chair.